Hey everybody, this is Writers in the Round. My guests this evening are two of my favourite songwriters, and not just because they're sitting within arm's reach of me did I say that. Ben Strawn and Ben Vanderhart, my guests. I want to start by, this is, as I say, a quote from Ernie Pike. I think he actually interviewed you, Ben, about the record.
Yeah, we did.
And he concludes his piece by saying, ultimately, by taking a deep look within, one can make a stronger connection to the outside world. It seems to me that that quote equally applies to both of you in terms of the way you write and the way you think about writing. What do you think about that?
Yeah, boy, that's a mouthful. That's a big idea. Yeah, I think that's so important for artists to have a self-awareness. And, you know, really that's, I think the best art comes from kind of that deep exploration of the human experience. And you can't explore really anyone else's experience. You just have to explore your own. I hope that you can convey it in a way that connects with people. You know, I think that's kind of a baseline for any artist. But then, you know, I was reading an interview not too long ago, and it's probably an old interview with Thom Yorke, but he was talking about how when they made the album OK Computer, he made a conscious decision to move away from introspective writing. And that was a, I mean, that was a big album from them for them. I mean, they were already kind of a national, international sensation. But he did something where he kind of excelled at writing introspectively and capturing kind of an insular experience. And then he decided, well, you know, I'm done with that. I'm going to try to write an album that kind of captures the culture and the era that we're in. And, you know, and it blew people's minds. And so, you know, as valuable as it is, I think, to have that self-awareness and to become a skilled introspective writer, there's also some value to being able to look outward and capture ideas through observation that are sort of beyond yourself, and not to just get stuck in kind of a navel-gazing rut.
Yes. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, there's a balance in everything, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it strikes me, listening to what you're saying, that that probably told us as much about Thom Yorke as anything he could have written that was deliberately introspective, don't you think?
Yeah.
For him to write that way.
Yeah.
Because you're still seeing the world through Thom Yorke's eyes and what matters to him or doesn't, you know.
It, and with our album, you know, the one that Ernie was referring to, it was a very conscious decision to say, well, we're, this concept about kind of the disparity between sort of, you know, our rational selves and our emotional selves and doing what we know is right versus what often our gut or our heart tells us to do. And so, you know, in this particular case, we were making a conscious decision to focus on the process of introspection and to write an album about kind of the, you know, the war within yourself between the rational and the emotional being, you know.
Okay, so you started out, as I guess most people do, writing at least in part to figure out who you are and what you think and what you feel. You became aware of this, so then you wanted to step away from it. So you end up writing about the process that you're trying to get away from. Is that about
no,
what happened?
Not necessarily. I think that just kind of looking, seeing that perspective in Thom Yorke's interview was like a good reminder to me that it's good to have an awareness and sort of both levels, both the like the internal and the external, and that I don't want to spend the rest of my career as a songwriter just focusing on myself.
Is that possible, you think?
Well, everything's going to be processed through your own paradigm, you know, and the filters and the categories and the things that you have names for. So, no, you can't objectively, but nothing in the world is, you know, we're all just like processing through our own personal experience. And I've said this before that, you know, as an artist, all you can do is hope to try to convey your experience of life in a way that's like true and meaningful enough that it resonates with other people and they say, yeah, that's been my experience too. And that's what makes art good, I think.
Agreed. And I think that if, as you say, if you are being true to yourself and you're doing your best to be honest with the people listening, I think people respond to that. I think that's, you know, that's what most of us are looking for in the work we listen to or look at, don't you think?
Yeah,
the sense that the person's I don't know, you know, I forget who it was who said it, but they said, you know, writing's easy, just open a vein and dip in a pen, you know.
Yeah, it's really powerful. It, you know, that people read genuineness, when true genuineness, when they hear it, when they see it, they know it. I've always tried to pursue musical ideas that are just really uncomfortable, but ultimately, like, you know, bring healing and bring joy and bring reconciliation through vulnerability and through true human connection.
As well as being a writer and a performer, you're also an excellent producer. And I thought it might be a good place to start to play a track from the album to give a sense not only of how you write and play, but also your production skills.
Thank you. I'd love that. I always prefer the full band to this, you know, stripped down acoustic set. So,
I can see why that, because you wrote with them in mind in the first place, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So it feels like you're sort of walking with one leg when you don't have the band with you. I wanted to play Wicked Sinner with the Blues because I like it. I think it's a great song. Would you care to say anything about it before I play it?
In general, I'd say that this song is kind of about regret and about wrestling with addiction and the idea of, if this were the last day of my life, would I be happy with the decisions that I made today or yesterday?
Blimey, Ben. How old are you again? This is Telemonster.
300 years old.
Yes. I'm still a wicked sinner with the blues. In crisis with a Christ I didn't choose. You sure I'm not in someone else's shoes? It isn't something I could just refuse. I can't make it make sense in ones and twos. Just grips me hard enough to leave a bruise. And still my head is full of loose ends. My mind is a viewfinder with two feet. My life is like a bomb.
Not bad for a first album, is it? And that's just one example of the wonderfully melodic, elegantly written and so carefully produced music on this record that caused several reviewers that I just came across online as just to be beside themselves rhapsodizing about it. The band is Telemonster. The writer and producer is my guest, Ben van der Haar, and also with us is Ben Strawn. And as I said, I don't know if I said this when the microphone was open, but I invited both Bens here without realizing just how much they had in common. This is a quote from Ben Strawn, and it I think it's going to resonate with Ben van der Haar. With what I've already written and what will hopefully come out next year, I guess I just want to communicate that having all kinds of emotions is okay. You can be in love and be sad at the same time. You can secretly love where you live and also want to get the hell out of that same place. You can want to curse the Bible Belt but still come running back to it. Life is full of all types of emotions and you don't have to pick one and stick with it. I want to make sad boy music for the sad boys and girls and hopeful music for the same boys and girls. Because deep down, we all really want to have hope. I want to write something for everyone. Ben's album is called Sea in Color. What did you have in mind when you caused it that?
I think I just, over the course of my life, I kind of just kind of lost sight of who I was or what I felt about life in general. So I just kind of felt like there was a lot of haziness and a lot of blurred lines in my life. As I was writing this album, I started to get those bits and pieces back, and there were just moments that I could appreciate a lot more, just even the little things, now than I could before. I mean, just hanging out with my wife or cooking a meal or just, like, going on walk. I just felt like I got more of myself back in the past year or so. And so, yeah, Seeing Color is just about kind of healing and reconciliation and, like, just getting back pieces of who you are and going through seasons and ups and downs and just trying to figure out where you fit in all of that. So,
yeah. I think it's worth noting that you're both in your... Well, actually, that's not true. Ben...
You gotta take a guess at my age here? I'm trying to decide whether to, like, let you kind of sit.
You're around 30.
Yeah, that's right.
And Ben Strawn, you're not.
No.
You're younger than that.
25.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There comes a point, I think, as teenagers, we got it knocked, right? We know everything we need to know. We know what we want. Well, that's not obviously not true of all of us.
Right.
But my sense is that it was true of both of you. It certainly was true for me, too, in many ways. I knew exactly what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't quite sure how to get there,
mm-hmm.
but I knew where I wanted to be. Then there comes a point, at some point in your 20s, when you start questioning everything about yourself, everything that you assumed, I want this, therefore I can get it. That's all it takes. I just have to want it. And I think there does come that point, which can be incredibly debilitating, where you start to question everything about yourself and your capacity for realizing your ambitions. And I don't know how to put that into words. You just get to kind of reach that point where you hit a bit of a wall.
Yeah.
That's the impression I'm getting from both of you about what you've written and why you wrote it. That happened to you, and you came out the other side. Is that a reasonable assumption on my part?
Yeah, for sure. It's funny because I didn't really learn to play guitar or write or anything like that until I was 16, 17, 18, just kind of around those
years.
Well,
you were forced to take piano lessons, I gather, when you were younger.
Yeah. I started taking piano whenever I was like 5, and I had those until I was like 15.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so a long time.
It's a long time to be suffering, because it didn't sound like you were much fun. Right?
No, I mean, piano lessons, whenever you're a kid, it's a love-hate relationship, because you never want to practice, and your parents always make you. And then after you come out the other side of having these things done, you're like, man, I'm glad I stuck with that. Like, I'm glad I have this skill.
It gave you this foundation.
Yeah,
right?
For sure. So whenever I learned guitar, I was like, oh, I learned piano. Like, I can do this. And I never really sang before. But I just had this, like, blind ambition, like you were talking about. Like, I wanted to be a songwriter. I knew that I was decent at poetry. I had taken piano before, so I just, like, went for it. In college is whenever I started actually writing, and I just played shows and just, like, got random people to play with me, and I just didn't even care. And then whenever I finally started to understand what it was to do music and to, like, that I really wanted to do it with the rest of my life, I just started getting extra self-conscious.
There comes that point where you're self-conscious. There's, you know, until that point, you're so caught up in the drive, doesn't it occur to you to think about anything beyond? Obviously, this is me talking, but that kind of, you get almost like that tunnel vision. Like, mm-hmm. all you can see is there's that goal.
Right.
I'm going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's play a song by you, Ben, before you guys have both got your guitars, and I'd love for you to play some songs for us, but. As with Ben Vanderhaar, Ben, this record is so beautifully realized, so nicely produced. It would seem to be a crime not to at least play one song from it. So I thought we'll start with "See in Color."
Yeah.
How's that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
So this is my guest Ben Strawn. The album is called "See in Color," and this is the title song.
I see it on the screen.
That's our guest, Ben Strawn. Seeing Color is the name of that. Both Ben Strawn and Ben Vanderhart went to schools with pretty good music programs, I think. You went to Covenant, Ben, and Ben Strawn, you went to Lee.
Mm-hmm. I was a music minor, so I was in the classical, but I was like a vocal emphasis. So, I'm in our music program.
Well, I'm trying to find some way to explain how you guys appear like this full blown. What did you do at Covenant, Ben? Were you in the music program there?
I was a music minor for like 3 months, and I washed out. because of my experience, I also took piano lessons when I was a kid, and sight reading was always really difficult for me, and I usually ended up playing things by ear. As soon as I had read through it enough and memorized it, then I completely forgot. And then I picked up guitar, and that was my main focus during middle school and high school. So by the time I got to college, I knew how to sight read, but it was just this huge gap between, you know, my ear and what I wanted to do. And, you know, most formal music programs require you to be pretty proficient in sight reading. And I think, you know, another thing that often happens in formalized music education, whether it's private lessons or in schools, it's pretty rare to find a teacher who's good at motivating students and finding what interests them and being an effective teacher, teaching them all the things they need to know, using kind of the art and the music that motivates them and inspires them. You know, I think what's more important in the academic environment is kind of a culture of creativity, a culture of sharing ideas. And I think that's what I had at Covenant College, was just the opportunity to play music kind of, you know, a round robin of different musicians and people who had different ideas and styles. And
it does seem as if people with those talents are drawn to that school, doesn't it?
Yeah. That was my experience there. And I think it ebbs and flows with, you know, just like this happens at every school, you know, every class is kind of a different culture and a different, you know,
that's
unique
people. That's true, but there does seem to be that commonality, you know. Over the last 15 years, I can think of any number of bands that, so where'd you go to school? Oh, we went to Covenant. Yeah. Is that where you met? Yeah, that's where we started playing. Yeah. You know, I've heard that a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of good, like, original music that comes out of Covenant, I've noticed.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, but I think that's true of Chattanooga in general. There's enough schools here that have kind of effectively created that culture that there are just a lot of really talented people who are constantly, you know, graduating and arriving on the music scene every day and bringing new and fresh ideas. And I think a lot of it does start in the schools. There's so many here.
At the same time, it would seem that the label that you started, Yellow Racket Records, that was your intent with that, was to create a kind of incubator.
Yeah, that's true.
A supportive environment, a place where people could meet kindred spirits and try things and try their ideas without judgment.
I think that's the only place for a record label in this day and age. But I think you can create a community of people who can gravitate around an idea and be unified in purpose and in creative direction and, you know, and have very academic conversations about what it is that we're trying to do and what we're trying to accomplish and what makes music good and what makes music bad. And I think that's the only way for Yellow Racket to be successful, is to grow as a grassroots movement like that and be focused around community more than industry.
I think it's a great way to approach it.
I don't think that corporations are very good at predicting what will be successful or what will resonate with people. And that's why you have so many fantastic enclaves of music, you know, cities that have developed their own music culture that didn't have anything to do with, that were totally unpredictable. And you have places like Seattle that developed its own sound, and Portland developed its own sound, and Indianapolis and Austin and Asheville and Athens, all these places where there weren't necessarily major players, but a grass movement sprung up and it was just irresistible. And then suddenly the major players come in and they say, we need to make money on this. You know, there's a spark that lit a fire over here. And
they fracture it.
Yeah. Well,
because the corporate approach to things is to create something that's predictable and that's stable, and that 2 years from now is going to be look and feel and taste basically the same as it does now. The music business, quote unquote, became corporate in the late 60s, early 70s. And if you look at the arc of music between the 50s and today, I think you can see what happened, you know, and how we've come all the way full circle back to the way it was in the 50s again, where musicians were making music. And yeah, we make records. They're good for jukeboxes. They're good to get the word out, but it's all about playing. That's what we do.
Well, and you talk about the arc of music since the 50s and 60s, and, you know, even going back earlier, something that I've really spent a lot of time pondering in the last few years is how so many of the genres that shaped the music that we listen to today and were just unstoppable forces in our culture sprung up from the most unexpected places. And by and large, I mean, this is Black History Month. By and large, most of them stemmed from African American culture. When you look at blues and jazz and swing and rock and hip hop and R&B and gospel and soul and funk, I mean, this is an incredible legacy that we're talking about. And none of those, you know, these were, they just took the world by storm, and none of them were manufactured, because you just, you can't manufacture it. It just, you know, it happened in places that were, where there was oppression and there was pain and there were people who were, you know, speaking, asking for justice and expressing themselves in ways nobody had ever heard before. And that's what drew people. And I think that's just an amazing.
Yes, I think it's, as you were saying before, that they made music as an expression of their feelings. And then somebody came along and said, you know, we could probably market this and make some money out of this, you know. But that wasn't, that didn't, I don't think, occur to the people making the music when they first started making it. They weren't thinking in those terms at all.
No.
And if you begin by, if you begin making music thinking in those terms, I think you're going to hit a dead end pretty quickly. Ben Vanderhart began by making music and working with his cousin and two other players. They formed Telemonster. They made the record. Ben also created a label, and he's now in the process of starting a record store.
That is true. Yeah.
On that same kind of foundation that you were describing, the label as a kind of community center.
Yeah.
Yeah, we sell records, but this is also a place you can come and have a cup of coffee and talk about music. Mm-hmm. And somebody like Ben can come in and play songs if he wants to.
Yeah, I really just wanted kind of a lightning rod for Chattanooga musicians and creative people and music lovers of all kinds to come and gather. And most of these ideas, these harebrained ideas that I've come up with, have really just come from looking at the landscape of Chattanooga music and saying, well, what's missing? What would I like to see here? I wanted to see a record label here. You know, lots of places to perform and lots of places to record. We don't have a lot of entities in the music business arena when it comes to management, publishing, sync licensing, record labels. And so I wanted to create something along those lines. And the next logical step, you know, we've talked about Rough Trade Records before, and you've got Light in the Attic Records and Captured Tracks, any number of other small labels that have brick and mortar stores where they sell other people's records. And to me, that was just a logical step.
Does this almost resonate with you, Ben? It's almost like talking to Ben Vanderhaar here is like talking to you, Ben Strawn, in terms of your ambitions and your goals.
Yeah. Well, I've wanted a record store to be in Chattanooga for forever. So I was telling you that earlier. Because just a couple days ago, I really wanted to get vinyl, and they didn't have it at the Books a Million in Cleveland. And I was like, man, I wish I could just go to Chattanooga and go to the record store there and pick it up. And as you were talking about everything is with, you know, soul and funk and all these kinds of things, I think the reason, like you said, that music was so good because it was creative and because they felt something and they had to express it. Whereas now in the music industry is that it's like there's so much of it. I feel like the only way to make money is to limit creativity and to like pick and choose a type of person, a type of song, a type of production, and then just put all your money into it because it's a formula, it's an algorithm at that point. There's never been any truly massive bands, any truly life-changing, culture-changing music that's been produced that way. Like, it's come organically. And I even think about, like, someone that's huge now, like Taylor Swift. Like, she started with this guy, Nathan Chapman, who's from Lee, and he had no big, like, production credits at that point, but they were just friends, and they believed in each other, and they worked hard, and they made it, you know? And I feel like something like Yellow Racket, or even what we did at La Blanca Studios, like, you just have to find someone that you believe in and just try to make something authentic and something you believe in. And I think that's where that drive comes in, because tunnel vision is necessary. Like, I don't think anybody can get
anywhere. I think it is too.
Yeah, like, I don't think anyone can get anywhere without that. At the same time, you have to remain introspective and self-aware to know where you need to improve. And so I'm really thankful for my tunnel vision at the beginning, because I think it just projected me to keep getting better.
Play a song for us, would you? Our guest is Ben Strawn.
All right, this is something new on the album. It's the fifth track. And I think we were talking about earlier just what seeing color meant. And I think something new really kind of encapsulates that, other than the title track, the best, just because I wanted something different, or I wanted something new. I wanted something that I felt like I could hold on to. It was right in front of me the whole time. So that's what the song's about.
Demons, I felt breathless for so long, and I've been wandering through the desert where my mind was for so long. And though I searched for something true, and though I searched something new, but I haven't found it yet. Oh, I've been reckless, I've been wretched. It's been so hard for me, babe, to be your man, 'cause I've got a devil with a pitchfork resting on my shoulder. I'm an inch away from being damned. And oh, I've searched for something true. And oh, I've searched for something new. And oh, I've searched for a way out to your love, but I haven't found it. I've been searching for my whole life, babe. When I look in front of me, I see your face. You're the only sunshine I wanna lay in. Bring me out of the darkness. Let's turn another page.
P. Ed Strawn, Something New is the name of that. Everything that I've seen in print, Ben, about the record store is saying that it'll be open in the spring.
It's the plan. April 2020 is what we're
shooting. There were mention of pop-ups before that. Have you done any pop-ups yet?
Not yet. We're still doing some fundraising, still getting some investors, but we're getting close to signing a lease on a space, and we'll get announce that soon.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, got accounts, started setting up accounts with distributors and record labels and folks like Fat Possum and Secretly Canadian and Red Eye Distribution and all kinds of great music 3 days away from shipping. So,
what I've gotten from talking to people recently is there seems to be more and more people, which makes sense, leaning towards making 7-inch discs, EP or singles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a general trend. For me personally, I still love records. And when I say records, I mean albums, you know, LPs, whatever you want to call it. And so I can't imagine stopping the effort of trying to make an album, even if it's hard. Ben and I were talking about this a little earlier, and maybe you can speak to this, but there's so much music out there that it's difficult. You make a record, you put it out, and it's kind of here today, gone tomorrow. It's a flash in the pan. People get really excited about it, and you've put, you know, 2 years of your life in, you know, making this album. And but there's another album, you know, from somebody else right on its heels, and so it's hard to make a record that has real staying power in a music economy that prizes like singles. And it's a little bit like fast fashion, to be honest. Make it quickly, put it out quickly, you wear it for a little while, and then it goes in the trash because it's worn out and you're on to the next thing. And so a lot of what we're trying to do with the record store is kind of preserve some of the, I suppose, maybe some of my nostalgia. But there's so many people out there. I think that's the reason vinyl sales are growing, is because as music in a streaming age becomes more and more fleeting, it's here today, gone tomorrow, like I said, there are more and more people who are looking for kind of more intentional experiences, tactile experiences with music, and I think that's why people are going to vinyl. Humans are collectors, and we're not that different than raccoons or ravens or whatever. And we,
okay.
You know, the more
two things to consider. The best-selling vinyl LP so far has been Abbey Road.
That's right. They just celebrated their 50th
anniversary.
Which is
50 years old.
So there's a huge push.
So the notion that the music is fleeting, while I grant you there's a lot of truth to that because of the way it's marketed with streaming. But music like Introspector or Ben's record, no, the first time I listened to it, I thought this, in both your cases, this music has heft. It has body. And so every time I listen to it, I'm reminded again of how good it is. Now, having said that, to reiterate your point, I am deluged with things to listen to. And so I'm listening to both your records again because I was about to talk to you. I go back and listen to them again. Go back and realize again how good they are. Every time you play a gig, you are going to get the same reaction from people who come to see you. Wow, these guys are good. Where do I find their recordings? So while on the one hand, in terms of streaming, yeah, it probably does seem fleeting, but this record has legs. This record will sound good 2 years from now.
I appreciate that.
5 years from now. Same is true for Ben's. So I don't think you need to worry about that. I think you just need to concentrate on catching people's attention.
Sure. And yeah. I think I often can come off as a negative Nancy on these kind of things, but I think a lot of it is just derived from sort of the practical experience of working a release and create an album. And that's not to say that I think of my music that way, because that's the reason I'm never going to stop the pursuit of making a great album, because that's what I love to do. And all of my favorite music is from albums. But I simply say that to say that those are the kind of obstacles that
we face in trying
to grab people's attention. And
I can imagine just how disconcerting the whole thing is. But you are going to be entering into the Road to Nightfall pretty soon.
Yeah, that's true. We're going to be, Telemonster is going to be doing the initial round of Road to Nightfall on February 21st at the Grand Falloon. So please come on out and vote for us.
It's a Friday, right?
It's a Friday night. Yeah, what I mean, the first round, kind of the key measure is how many people come to your shows. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it's American Idol style.
How many people vote for you?
Yeah, how many people vote for you? Right. So, yeah, we're kind of just starting to ramp up the campaign of getting people to come out and, you know, put their vote behind us. And
assuming that goes well, that becomes a cycle.
Sure.
So you play the first gig, that goes well. They bring you back for the final, the ultimate winner goes on to play Nightfall. You get studio time out of it, which you don't really need, but you also get that bounce, that all that attention.
Yeah.
But it is, as you were saying, Ben, it is that tunnel vision thing. You've got to maintain that singular focus, you know. It's a big commitment.
Yeah.
Something that you've talked about, because you said that all four members of the band, in the time you were making the record, you also had, each of you had two children.
That's right, yeah. I think in the press release we said that we had 8 kids in the course of 3 years collectively. That's where that album was made, you know. We were recording between 9 p.m. and 2 a.m. after all the kids were in bed, and we were piecemealing it together, and that was, you know, but that was part of our identity. That's who we were, and that's why the album sounds the way it does and talks about the things that it does, is because it was unique to our experience.
So what you're thinking in terms of, I mean, you've got so many different things going on.
I know, but, yeah, you talk about tunnel vision, and it's like, yeah, I guess I'll have tunnel vision about the label and the store and the band. And
for all three of your eyes.
That's right, yeah.
Well, you have a partner with the record store, somebody who's going to take care of the day-to-day, is
that's
that true?
Right, yeah. I've got a general manager who is also a bastion of the music scene here. A lot of folks know Abe Hauk, who has played in Elk Milk and the Dead Testaments and the Bardos. You know, he and I go way back. The very first show that Telemonster ever played was a show at JJ's Bohemia called Native Tongues, and Elk Milk was also playing their first show that night. And so we've kind of been in each other's, circling in each other's space for a long time. And I told him we were thinking about opening a record store, and he said, I'm in, you know, so.
So what you're thinking about the road to Nightfall, if you were to win, are you ready to make that kind of commitment?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's going to look a little bit different because of convictions that we have at kind of the foundation of our career and our reason for making music. I've seen a lot of artists who've kind of given up everything to blindly kind of just pursue fame and fortune and, you know, success as a musician. And a lot of times, and this is true of any industry, whether you want to be a CEO or, you know, or kind of climb to the top of the ladder, often they ask you to give up everything to do that. And, you know, part of the reason we started our own record label is because we said, no, we're not going to make those compromises, because we think that the main reason that our art is good is because it comes from a particular place and it comes from this set of values that make us us. And none of us have any interest in, you know, going on the road 250 days out of the year and just kind of, I don't know, giving up everything else, making all those other sacrifices for success or for it to make it big, you know, which I think is just, it's a huge crock. But that doesn't mean that you can't make incredible music and that you can't release
it doesn't.
In a professional
way. No, it doesn't. And I think what you're describing
an audience
is a kind of corporate model, you know, that the label has put so much money into this record that you're going to have to be on the road for the next 2 years to pay that back and to sure. realize any kind of income for yourselves.
I don't want to demonize all labels. There are great labels out there who don't follow that. And we just thought that we had an opportunity to be a good record label and to define what we wanted music to look like in Chattanooga, or at least, you know, create our own destiny in terms of how we wanted to make music. And to me, you know, having the record store and these other ventures is a way for us to be able to achieve those goals and maintain
those
values.
I think so, too. It's you know, it seems to me that you're following that same model that came out of punk in the 70s, where you try to keep the whole thing on a more manageable scale. You don't start with albums, you start with singles. You play, but you don't necessarily, you don't go out on the road for months and months at a time. You play gigs and you know, you're a working musician. You're not looking to become a millionaire.
Right, exactly. And you made a comment earlier about there are a lot of bands who they're put in that position because they've taken on huge debt from the labels that they work with. And, you know, a lot of people have asked me, why would you start a record label now? You know, nobody needs labels. And we've really tried to embrace the DIY aspect of the music industry and to say, look, we're going to be a conduit for the artists who are on our roster, and they can do so many of these things themselves, but we're going to help each other and leverage our relationships to build new partnerships and to kind of grow together. But we can still keep our costs down, and we're going to be sensible about how much money we put in, because we all have similar goals and ideas about why we're doing this and what we want to get out of it.
Yeah, I think it strikes me that the whole thing works better if you are operating as a collective. The notion of DIY, if taken literally, is a bit of a dead end.
Sure.
You know, it's just as Ben was saying earlier, that the odds are just insurmountable.
Well, the other thing, too, I was thinking about this earlier, is that there are so few people who are well-established in the music industry who are going to give you a hand up because they don't need you. And so I think that's one of the things that I learned early on is however many folks that I reached out to in the publishing world or the sync licensing world or other labels or, you know, whatever, they don't need you. And so they're not highly motivated to go out of their way to elevate you. And so my philosophy has really changed to say, let's build this together. Let's make it a grassroots effort, because I think all the best musical movements have happened from that place. You made that comment about how the music industry was industrialized only in, you know, since the 50s or 60s, you know, maybe arguably starting in the 20s or 30s. But I think that's absolutely true. And sometimes it's easy to forget that people have been making music for centuries outside of this industrial ecosystem, and very few of them made any money. It was something that was not really a profession unless you had a wealthy patron like a king or a
that's true.
You know what I mean? And so it may be that we get back to a point where you know, it's really hard to sell music, but that doesn't mean that people are going to stop making music. It's in our blood, and we're going to do it no matter what.
Well, I think I think at least the way it looks to me is that it's come back to musicians make music for audiences. The record or whatever medium you sell your music through is a souvenir of that performance, but it's the performance that matters.
Yeah.
That's where your life is. You know, you're a performer, not a record maker. You know, that was a really small window when that was a reality. Mm-hmm. You know, and even then, only for a few people, really.
Yeah.
So, do you want to close with a song, Ben?
All right. That'll be good. All right. This is a song I have not recorded yet, but I do think it'll be on the next Telemonster album, and I like to call it my punk country song. So here we go.
Think it makes you older. I idolize myself in hopes that you will toe the line, but I don't admit it's true. To rest our heads in the shadow of the valley of the dead. Come on, let's go. We'll get fuel on the road. Our future grows, but our excitement doesn't show. Gotta trust your mind, gotta trust your mind. Gotta trust your mind. Gotta trust your mind, gotta trust your mind.
Ben van der Hart, his band is Telemonster. They will be in The Road to Nightfall, which is going to be a grand falloon as far as Ben's concerned, Friday the 21st of this month. So that's about 7 o'clock, I think, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Mr. Strawn, what have you got going on? You're not in The Road to Nightfall, are you?
I'm not.
You should be.
Maybe one day. That actually is kind of a goal of mine for next year. I kind of wanted to do that. But yes, my next full band show is February 27th at the Bicycle Bar here in Chattanooga. And then I'm going on tour in March and then just kind of around southeast area. And then I have another show, full band here in Chattanooga at the Woodshop, April 3rd with a girl named Jack Thompson, who's amazing. So I'm really looking forward to that one. But we've kind of got the full band thing going now, and I'm looking forward to those shows. So it'll be cool.
Well, thank you so much to both of you for doing this. My only regret is that we don't have nearly enough time to talk to both of you, and I'm hoping that we can do this again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
This is Writers in the Round, and my guests are Ben Strawn and Ben van der Hart. They'll be back again. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.